I very much enjoyed listening to those talks. And even though we're over time, I'm beginning to think it's really a good thing to always be last, because then you get the last word to some extent. So what I did was change everything I was going to talk about, because there was a lot of interesting stuff here around naps and recovery, and these are areas which is the theme of this. You have to hit the enter bar when you come up here. Okay. Thanks very much. All right, so let's begin in the beginning. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about napping and recovery. These are topics that I have been obsessing about for 30 years, but it takes a long time to get really good data on these, and you've heard some of the epidemiologic data already from people. So first of all, what do we know about napping around the world? And Sarah introduced us to the importance of a literature that's growing and actually started many years ago on, is napping good or bad? Now, here's why we're obsessed with that, I would argue. It's this. When countries transition from agrarian to industrial economies, two changes occur in the timing of sleep. You can get this in my 1989 book on napping, which is an exhaustive look at the scientific literature up to that point in time on napping. So a lot has happened since then. And by the way, there are more books on napping than any other topic in the sleep field. Did you know that? Everybody's an expert on it. I mean, we have lay writers, we have scientists, everybody. Everybody thinks they know what napping is and what it's about and what it's for. What do you think those two changes are? You know what an agrarian economy is. That means farming and milking cows and going to bed when the sun goes down. And what's an industrial economy? Well, that means a busy industrial-based economy. Well, shift work and siesta is outlawed and shift work is instituted. So napping begins to disappear, not in every culture, but in the vast majority when industrialization occurs. It is happening right now in China. The Chinese government has basically said you cannot all be asleep at the same time. We have an economy to run here. And that's what happens in industrialization. You can't afford to have all humans asleep at the same time. People say, well, that's government doing that or industry. No, it isn't. It's us. It's all of us. Because we want our orange juice in the morning and our nice suits and our air-conditioned buildings, and that's industrialization. That's what that brings. So we're looking at napping patterns primarily in university students for a long time, about 7,000 of them through the 1980s. And we defined two types of napping, and one was called replacement napping. It's compensatory napping is another word. What is that? That is when people don't normally nap unless they've gotten less sleep the night before. Then it increases the window for the siesta. That is, it increases the dip in the afternoon, as Dan Kripke was talking about it, where you get sleepy, the postprandial period, which is not very much related to sleep. Now, it really is a product of this interaction. We're pretty sure of it, of the interaction of the circadian oscillator and the homeostat, the homeostatic drive for sleep, because when we looked at all the factors that predict the day of napping, the only one that reliably predicted it in university students was the hour they awoke that morning. And if they awoke a half hour to an hour earlier than they normally awoke, you could pretty much bet a nap was coming that day. Okay, so it spreads that window out. So it very likely is true that napping actually, there's a compensatory component to getting sleepy in the afternoon. Although I want to caution you, in many siesta cultures, and Italy would be a classic example of a country that went actually from agrarian to industrial, but more or less retained its siesta. And there are others like that. Greece is another one. But many of them, like Chile and that, and China, haven't done that. They've gotten rid of it. But the important thing I want to caution you about is siesta doesn't mean sleep. I know the word means sleep, but it doesn't mean everybody's asleep. It can mean passive activities is what it can mean. So we don't really know how many people are actually sleeping when they take that break of 2 or 3 or 4 hours. But it also comes out of orbital mechanics, again, just like all sleep-wake behavior does. On the Yucatan or in Panama, everybody's up at 4 or 5 in the morning. You work till 10 or so. Now it's too hot. Everybody's sort of out of the loop then until about late afternoon or early evening and then back active again. So it splits the wake period up if you're in not all equatorial countries, but many. The other kind of napping, which was less frequent, replacement napping we found in about 75% of healthy young adults. Appetitive napping was in about 25%, and these are people who we originally called them closet nappers. These people are napping, and they are napping every day, but they're hiding it. And in the sleep field, many of you know Al Rechtschaff and or Mark Rosegard. It is amazing over the years when we did this book in 89 how many of my colleagues came to me in a whispered tone said, I secretly nap every day, but I'm reluctant to say anything about it. Why? Well, it's a sign of weakness in our culture, caught napping. You don't want to be caught napping. It's like, okay, that's like a bad, like you willfully slept when you should have been awake, in the workplace, no less. So you hear all these articles. The last 10 years, we heard a lot of articles about people sleeping in the workplace, and the progressive technology companies were going to have napping rooms, and there is some of that going on, but I don't think it's terribly widespread as endorsed. Okay, so just to back, I think napping, as Sarah pointed out, and Dan and others, I think this is still an area for fruitful discovery of trying to understand it. Somebody said Dave Ninges works a lot with the military. That's a dangerous statement. I don't, actually. I'm funded for basic science by various agencies like Air Force Office of Scientific Research. I don't work with the military, okay? I will occasionally go up in some strange plane just to see what that's like, but I don't do that. I'm not out on the battlefield pumping medications into people. Okay, whatever mythology people have in their head, that's not me. However, they pose interesting questions. So one question they asked us in the early 80s was, if somebody has to be awake for a day and a half, and they're only going to get 2 hours of sleep, when should they get the 2 hours sleep? In the first 6 hours of wakefulness, the first afternoon, the first night, the second afternoon, the second night, when should you get it? And we had this idea, based on our review of the literature back in the 80s, that if there is a buildup of the sleep homeostat, you could maybe prevent that buildup from going as fast if you got sleep earlier, not later. We called this prophylactic napping. Now, as you'll see, that went away when we did studies with pilots, for obvious reasons. But we published the paper showing that really does work. The earlier you take the nap, even before you're sleep deprived, the more benefit you get later from it. It's actually better to prevent the homeostat from building too high than it is, as Bob's yawning over here. Okay, take a nap, Bob. Now, I want to just show, this is a later experiment now on this. These are the placebo control groups in an experiment in which people were kept awake. This group was kept awake for 4 days, 88 hours. This is a large number of subjects. This group was given a two-hour nap, here it is, in the middle of the night, 2 to 4 a.m., and then 2 to 4 p.m. each day. So they got 4 hours of sleep split into two-hour naps. And this is cognitive throughput performance on the digit symbol substitution. And what you see in the group that doesn't get any sleep is this huge drop at night. They recover a little in the day. This is circadian recovery. Then another giant drop and then up and then another giant drop. But look what just a few naps do to this function. It is quite remarkable. And to play over to the work that Dr. Stickgold and others have done on the importance of sleep, possibly for memory, this is an area where we think we see some discrimination between taking a stimulant or wake-promoting drug, caffeine or a controlled substance, versus getting a nap. While the stimulants will help maintain alertness in that and might improve lapsing and reduce it, like the naps, the naps seem to be differentially good for the memory-based tasks. And so it looks like you might get something out of sleep that you don't get out of a stimulant. It's popular in my field to sometimes say some of these wake-promoting drugs are somnolytic. They substitute for sleep. But I know of no chemical substitute for sleep. I know of nothing you can take where the next day you function as though you had sleep and all you took was some sort of a chemical agent. We may one day have that, and that's a separate discussion maybe for later on today. Now, we took this idea, demonstrated in the lab, that the naps early on could help and naps are good for you, and took it out in the field with airline pilots. And these guys are flying Pacific routes. And this is a study with NASA Ames done for the FAA. Kurt Graber and Mark Rosekind and I and others did it. And when we did it, I said, let's do a real experiment. Let's randomize half of these commercial airline pilots who are flying Pacific routes, Seattle to Honolulu, Honolulu to L.A., L.A. to Tokyo, Tokyo to Honolulu. You get the idea. 11 days out on the run. Let's randomize half of them to get a nap in the cockpit seat and the other half no nap in the cockpit seat. And they only get one nap, and it's only a 40-minute period, and they can sleep for no more than 20 minutes, and they have to sleep sitting up right in the cockpit seat while the airplane's flying. And the other two pilots, in those days there were still three, there was a second officer, still three pilots in the cockpit in these 747s. But the other two pilots will operate the aircraft. Now, this is a huge issue because we had to get approval, and everybody was worried, the public, there's a law that says you can't sleep in the cockpit, so it's a very serious thing to get this. And then we put electrodes on them. We went with them, we put ambulatory recordings on them, and we had PVTs in the cockpit, and we measured, and we measured, and we measured. This is a very onerous study to do. And when we finished it all up, what we showed was that, first of all, they could all sleep in the cockpit, no problem. No problem. And secondly, the sleep was normal physiologic sleep. It was only 20 minutes long, and we allowed a wake-up period to get over sleep inertia, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But the remarkable thing was, and it reduced PVT lapsing, but I'm going to show you a different metric here. I'm going to actually show you intrusions of microsleeps, actual stage one sleep, into the waking EEG during the final 90 minutes of flight, from top of descent to landing. This is the most critical period of flight. This is where 68% of hull losses occur. A hull loss is a euphemism for a crash. So you really want your pilots on target, on task, from top of descent to landing. When you can hear this happen in an airplane when you're flying, when as you get closer, half hour out or so, suddenly, on a long-haul flight, it can be, they drop in altitude a bit, the plane comes down, and you know that's top of descent. And at that point, your risk factor goes up from very safe to much higher. Okay, that's the time to put that seatbelt on, get the seat up, and make sure you know where the exits are. All right, so what we did was eliminate the micro. Here are microsleeps occurring in pilots right up to top of descent to landing, even during that critical phase. And this is what the 20-minute nap in a 12-hour flight did. Wiped it right out. So a little bit of sleep goes a very long way for healthy people. Be careful here. That's less true for an apnea patient, for example, who is obstructing during the sleep and doesn't really get much recovery benefit from it. But it's more true for a narcoleptic, and I'll let Eric and others talk about that, or clinically sophisticated. All right, so we did this. The United States never adopted cockpit napping. The rest of the world adopted, all the other aviation around the world adopted it, because we're afraid to let anybody sleep anywhere because that's bad. And then they said, Dave, we can't call this prophylactic napping. The pilots, I mean, you know. This is just opens it up for jokes. And so I said, well, okay, call it plan napping. No, they said, that's, you know, plan. That sounds management. They said, Dave, how about power napping? Oh, boy. So it's so American, right? We're going to power nap. You know, it's that, and it's perfect. It is actually perfect for these sort of dominance jobs, CEOs or pilots. You know, I'm going to power nap now. And so you hear this concept everywhere, like, I can get by on. Now it's become an excuse. It's become synonymous with, I can get by on 20 minutes sleep a day. No, you can't. Not according to our data. At least we would challenge you. So I have it on USA Today one time. They were going on and on about power nap. I said, look, put this in your paper. Any CEO or person in the world who says they can get by on that little sleep, I will give them a free 10-day period in my laboratory, and all they have to do is let me put them on that sleep and measure them. And, you know, then let's see if that's really true. Now, we asked another question about napping, very serious one. This is for the space program. Could we stop the cumulative buildup and impairment that we see when people sleep, say, only 4 or 5 hours a night? An impairment by splitting the sleep into an anchor sleep and a nap. So is 5 hours at night as good as 4 hours at night and a 1 hour nap? Or you get the idea now, we can play with this in 18 different combinations. And then we randomized them to all these combinations. These are the naps here, the anchor sleeps, and we kept them on that for 14 days in the lab. 10 days. And then we looked at the outcome of this. And I'm only going to show you one slide. It's a kind of complicated area. This shows you the surface map that looks up is bad on this. So the more you're in the red, the more you developed impairment over time. And you're looking here at the anchor sleep duration going from 4 to 8 hours and the nap going from nothing to 2.4. So 5.2 and 2 hours is about 7 hours of sleep these two give you, and you can stay down in the blue. So we can rotate this thing around and look at it and say, okay, Here's what happens as I increase the nap duration. I bring that impairment, developing impairment, down. So do split sleep schedules work? Yes. Do they work better than a single episode of equivalent total sleep? No. It's just the same deal, okay? You can it's additive. You get more. On the other hand, is it good to take a nap if you're going to work a night shift? And the closer you sleep to the night shift, probably the more prophylactic benefit you get from the nap, power benefit. Okay. But there's a dark side to naps. Now, hold on,
I'd like to begin with the descending subtraction task. Remember to work as fast and accurately as you can. Your starting number is 931.
931,
this guy has been awake for 52 hours.
14,
he's lying in bed in the dark. He's doing an incredibly difficult mental arithmetic task. This task, we cooked this up to completely overload short-term working memory. I give him a number, 931. He has to subtract 9 from it, say the answer out loud, 8 from that, the answer out loud, 7 from that, the answer out loud, 6 from that. In other words, both the numerator and denominator are changing constantly. He's been awake 52 hours. And you listen to him and you'd say, you know, that's pretty good. In 3 minutes, he did 70-some correct.
He made
3 or 4 errors. But when he's fully alert, he's done this task many, many times. Before when he was lying in bed in the dark 52 hours earlier, before any deprivation, he got 93 correct, no errors. So he's slow. This is the cognitive slow. He's off by 20 to 25%. It's a big deficit, but you can't really tell it. That's what I often say to people. You can't tell who's sleep deprived. All I have to do is give you a shower and dress you up, and I can keep you awake for 5 days. And unless you're watching me very closely, you can't tell who that person's sleep deprived. It's very hard. You have to watch their slow eyelid closures, and that's another lecture. How we do know when somebody's going to make a mistake on a threat detection or is going to have an attack while they're driving. We know that from monitoring certain things on the face. All right. So he does his thing, and now he's going to sleep for 2 hours. Lots of slow wave sleep. I'm going to show you something that's very much like what Eric showed you, only this is in a healthy person. 120 decibel bell next to his bed with a light on the phone. His task is to reach over as fast as he can, answer it, and talk to me. He never, trust me, nobody ever answers this. So what I do is say their name, and boom, just like that, they respond. I say their name. All right, so here, let's get past this point here. All right, okay.
Are you awake?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. How long since I spoke to you last?
120 minutes.
Ninety minutes.
And on a scale from 1 to 10, where 1 is very wide awake and 10 is very sleepy, how do you feel now?
He's a 6. You know what he was before he went to sleep? A 9. He says he's more alert now. He's less sleepy.
Hang the phone up and lie back.
I'll let you be the judge of that. Wait till you hear what he does. He's telling me he's less sleepy than before he went to sleep. He's having a little trouble. He's wired up with EEG, keep in mind.
Can you see to hang it up?
There. Got it.
Would you agree he's interacted with me socially a little bit?
As fast and accurately as you can. You're starting number 648.
748.
That's the last one he'll get right. But wait till you hear what his brain does do.
30,
now, I won't let him go back to sleep. So 30. If he doesn't talk, I say continue. He only gets a few seconds before I say it. 10 or so.
500 and...
There's no working memory here. I would argue that the prefrontal cortex looks completely offline. Some tiny few neurons that do social interaction are apparently... It's entirely possible that social interaction requires virtually no real brain tissue. That's a little harsh, but... Now, this is a little boring, but hang on. There's something good coming, and it's coming in response to my stimulating. Now, I don't know, Eric, if you said it, but... With a child, you know, if you've got a 5-year-old at home, they're sleeping deeply a few hours in. go make a noise next to their bed. They'll sit up and do automatic behavior for you and stuff, a lot of them. And in a lot of families, that's a common. You could trigger this stuff. I'm going to trigger it in by saying continue. Yeah, no, he's so lost, poor guy. I say continue, and he does this. I love the complex, the polysyllabic words, concepts that almost run together, people in skin brackets.
That's good.
Okay. I have to follow the protocol. It says he's done. 3 minutes are up. Now, here's what's interesting. Now I'm going to do the digit span from the Wexler Adult Intelligence Scale. I'm going to read him numbers, and he has to repeat them back as I read them. And if he gets them right, I add an additional number. I keep making the string longer until he fails. Then we're going to do it backwards. He's still lying in the bed in the dark.
5, 4, 6, 1.
8, 1, 9, 2, 7, 3, 8. I get no answer here, so we... I would argue he's falling back asleep.
4, 7, 1, 5, 9, 2, 8.
4, 7, 9, 1.
Let's see the reversals here.
5, 2, 9, 8.
Now backwards. 9, 2, 3.
3, 2.
He gets that
9,
one. Three
8,
units.
9, 1, 6.
Not that one. But the principle's still in there.
Eight,
he reverses 6
five,
and 1.
6, 1. 6.
Here we
five,
go.
2, 1.
6, 2, 1. Would never go chase the any of those economies. Would go chase the one that began
with the 6. An economy that begins with a 6 is a serious economy. So, independently going the other way. Okay, so you get the idea. This is, you know, minutes later, when I go in, yeah. So I go in and take the electrodes off, and he is finishing. He gets up out of bed. I sit him in a chair, taking the electrodes off, and he says, he's filling out a questionnaire. Sorry, I've got to get us past this here. Let me do this. And he says, he gets to a question, were you awake when the bell rang? He said, Dr. Dinges? And I said, yes. He said, the bell didn't ring. I said, well, then answer appropriately. And anyways, we went through it. It was clear he had a complete amnesia. And in fact, when it said, how do you think you did on the descending subtraction task, he said, Dr. Dinges, yes. We didn't do that task. And I said, really? Are you sure? Yeah, no. He said, I don't. So his first memory was of me walking into the room, despite the social error. Now, we're looking at EEG. I have to apologize. Before the day of digital EEG in our lab, this is back in the early 80s, and, of course, I was running the experiments, and we didn't have it digitized, but I can assure you if I showed you the waveforms, you would not be able to see clear and dramatic changes in that EEG. So it probably is going to take more quantitative analyses to extract some of these states, and probably high-density arrays would be interesting. Years ago, Kleitman, when he studied sleep-deprived people, said, I see something called dreaming awake, semi-dreaming, he called it. And I used to see it, too, until I computerized my performance test batteries. Now we don't see it because we don't ask people to speak anymore. They just sit and type on computers and responding. It's a pity because language carries out of the mouth comes a lot of interesting cognitive information, not just social. And here's semi-dreaming. We used to see this in people like him when they're sleep-deprived. So he's doing descending subtraction task. 923, very sleep deprived, but on target, on task. 923, 915, 907, 900, and 894. Hit my dog with my mommy. What? Nothing. And then people smile at you. Nothing. And I play the tape back later. It's my dog with my mom. And then it... And Kleitman saw it. We saw it. But the age of computers wiped it out. So a fertile area here is to start... Let language, let voice tell you the status of the brain, not just typing. Okay. Because I think there's an error monitoring that goes on with typing that is not necessarily there with language. Now, caffeine blocks sleep inertia. This is stunning. And I mean severe sleep inertia. We've wondered for years, why are people taking caffeine in high dose in the morning? I thought you were supposed to take that after you'd been awake a long time and are tired. Okay, they're addicted. Well, yes, some people are, but not everybody's addicted. What's so pleasant about that drug in the morning? And it is a drug, by the way. It's a potent adenosine-binding drug. Well, it turns out it's metabolic upregulator. And it is wonderful to get it in the morning. You can reverse sleep inertia through metabolic activity. Stand up, move around, turn on the lights, take a hot shower, and drink coffee. Does that sound like the morning for most people? And very rapidly you can come online. So we think what's going on is people are undersleeping. The sleep system intensifies to protect sleep and to give you recovery. You don't completely recover. You have intense sleep inertia. It's hard to wake up. You take your coffee, shower, and light in the morning, and boom, you're back online and good to go. So we think they're just using it to deal with reduced amounts of sleep, although you could arguably say that caffeine has other benefits. It also has a price to pay, and I'm not going to show you a slide, but it increases core body temperature when you drink too much of it. I mean by half a degree centigrade sustained, and it drives up catecholamines. We have data on doubling the levels of catecholamines in the bloodstream when you're pumping large amounts of caffeine down you. Now, we're now looking at, I'm going to end on this, recovery sleep. The sleep field doesn't have a lot of data on how much recovery you need, and yet it's a hugely important scientific question and has a lot of public policy implications because most regulations on how long people can work contain statements about how many days off they need to have. And if they're night shift workers, say truck drivers or pilots or whatever, we need to know how much time to give them. But we have no dose response studies on this. So the experiments we're about halfway through now and are beginning to show data on involve going a week at about 4 hours. It was arbitrarily picked to produce some sleep debt in virtually everybody. And then randomizing people to varying doses of a single night of recovery sleep from nothing to 12 hours. And then in one experiment, they get another night of randomized dose. And in this experiment, they get another week at 5 hours. And I'm just going to show you one slide. One slide here. This is work Siobhan Banks and others in my lab are doing. Based on the dose of recovery sleep we gave you, do your measures of subjective sleepiness, your lapses, your ability to resist falling asleep on the maintenance of wakefulness test, do they come back to your baseline and do they match a control group? And what's the shape of this function like? And what this data is showing is that subjective sleepiness pretty much recovers back to normal at around 8 or 10 hours, but not lapse rates and not a single night, not lapse rates and not maintenance of wakefulness test. Now, because these experiments are not fully done, meaning there are going to be 260 subjects in these studies, but when we're fully done, I'll say what we absolutely think we know. Right now, I'm just going to leave you with that impression that it's possible that some aspects, some of our measures, our sensitive measures of physiological sleepiness and sustained attention in that will indicate that one long recovery night's not enough after 5 nights of restricted sleep. But this is an area where we need a lot more work to be able to not only understand what's important about recovery, slow wave sleep, etc. There are weird things about this. This MWT function shows a slow wave sleep function. The slow wave sleep activity extracted through a fast Fourier transform from the EEG looks like the MWT function. 6 hours doesn't give you more than 4. We also have evidence in these experiments now, which we'll reveal this year at the sleep meeting, that there is REM homeostasis going on here. We are seeing shortened REM latencies in these subjects as we keep them on these schedules. So this picture is more complex, more interesting, I think, than we originally anticipated it would be, but stay tuned for that. And then finally, I'd just like to point out that there's a hedonic side to sleep. It's kind of fun to sleep. What feels better than getting in your bed at night and, you know, reading another chapter of Thermopylae or something, or watching some innate, you know, Jon Stewart rip the news apart with comedy or whatever you do, and then just going to sleep? It feels very good, and it's a good thing to sleep. And I like to say that sometimes consciousness is overrated. Anyway, thank you.